All right. Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a podcast about computer programming and technology in New York City. I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
Okay. So a lot's happened since our last episode. A lot of great things in New York City.
We have a new iPhone. Big news.
Yeah. The iPhone 5 came out.
That's crazy.
So let's talk about that to begin with. I've started developing iOS applications, and it's actually nice. I prefer iOS applications to Android development, for sure. But the thing where they're like, oh, we made it bigger, so you can use it. That was it. So you can use it with one hand.
Right.
Bullshit.
Yeah, the commercials with a thumb and...
yeah, no.
It's hand-sized.
Yeah, that is not true at all.
Not so much.
Because you still have controls at the top of the screen, and you elongated the screen, and now you can't thumb over and reach for those controls.
I was really impressed with the fact that they made it, like, I don't know, 20% taller, but the actual device is only a few millimeters taller, which is pretty cool.
If you hold it in your hand, it's 20% lighter, which is kind of nice. I didn't think it would be that nice, but no, it is really
20%,
nice.
20%, as it turns out.
It turns out quite a bit.
What a big difference.
Yeah.
Right.
Last weekend, I went to Maker Faire here in New York City, which
was so jealous, a
lot of fun. So what is Maker Faire? Maker Faire is this do-it-yourself project thing, but not for home construction, which a lot of people have done do-it-yourself for a long, long time. Instead, Maker Faire is the do-it-yourself movement, but when it comes to electronics, manufacturing.
Not just Etsy, but like...
Right. Not just crafts and things, but actually making things with microcontrollers, making robots, making new control systems for watering plants and
3D modelers for 3D printers.
So, this Maker Faire was brought to you by 3D printing. They definitely think that that is the future, and I mean, I can't disagree with them, but like...
Yeah.
If I had to take all of the booths and then squish them all together, I would say 50% of the real estate for booths was 3D printers, all kinds.
I've been following the Form One pretty closely. This is a Kickstarter project. Yeah,
right?
They just hit $1 million, and it's a stereolithographic printer printing with liquid. I guess it's like ABS plastic, but it's done in liquid and then firmed up with some sort of laser. Crazy stuff.
Huh.
The detail on it is just amazing.
Yeah, because right now, but before that one, the state of the art is they have either ABS or PLK, I think it is. It's like a corn type product, but it's literally just a string of plastic.
Yeah, you have to
fed.
You have to buy it by the spool.
You buy it by a spool. Yeah. Yep. And it gets fed up into the printer, and then the printer has a head that just moves in two dimensions, and then a base drops down a little bit, right?
And then melts it.
It heats it almost like a hot glue gun.
And they have this scaffolding that prints out, so you can print out overhangs and things like that. But you have to kind of, if you remember buying toys in the 80s where when you wanted to put the thing together, you had to break it out of its little plastic thing. You had to break all the little connections and then put your toy together. Something like that. It actually prints out this scaffolding, this holder that you have to break it all out and then kind of take a piece of like sandpaper or whatever and kind of finish it.
Yeah.
But the Form One doesn't, you don't even really have to do that. I mean, you kind of tear off a little bit of
scaffolding. It's that precise,
really
in the millimeter.
Precise. Right.
Wow. That's interesting.
And it prints out this almost Velcro like scaffolding. That's like really thin and kind of web like. And then you sort of, really, really cool. At least from the videos, amazing. So
a lot of the people were saying that all the magic is in the software, which is why we're sort of talking about it here, because we're software people. You create a 3D model of like a ball or a bracelet or something like that in any of your favorite 3D programs, but they all come with software themselves. And then the 3D software figures out the optimal way to print it while using the least amount of material possible, but still giving you the rigidity and strength that you need. And so what that means is that most of the things that come out are hollow on the inside, because they're like, well, if you can't see it, then you don't need to print it, except where the structure is large enough that would cause a structural integrity problem.
Right.
And so in that case, they do print sort of like the scaffolding you were talking about. It's like a honeycomb on the inside of the thing to give it structural integrity, but still using very little things. This month's Wired magazine is all about 3D printing. And it does seem like it's going to be the future. This is like the missing piece. So the Maker Faire stuff, the Maker and Make magazine, which is what really started it, kind of came around when electrical engineering components became cheap enough that the home user with a computer engineering degree could... could do it on their own, right? They could get a microcontroller. Right. They could wire up a breadboard. They could wire up – actually, even getting printed circuit boards is pretty cheap and within the range of the home person.
And now we're at the point where anyone that has a basic understanding of a 3D modeling program that could export like a CAD format or something can print their own pretty much whatever. I mean, you're printing out toys. A lot of people do chess sets.
A lot of people do toys and chess sets. Even Kickstarter. So like the first watch mods for the iPod were not that great. Yeah. But this guy printed out a two-scale version that it would snap the Nano into the watch mod and then print it out in 3D. And then
have you seen the new Nano, by the way? That's a real disappointment.
Yeah. Really sad. They went away from the
watch. They went away from the watch deal, which, man.
I wish I understood that better. I
feel like they really had something there, too. Like that Nano, I would still buy that.
I do wish I could write apps for that Nano.
Yeah.
You can't. It has the touch screen and everything. Right. Like, I feel like my app could just be one more little thing on there.
Especially since the Kickstarters for the watched ones have not really come to fruition. The Pebble or whatever it's called.
Pebble's on its way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so they keep saying. Well, hopefully it actually ships.
I pre-ordered without having to put money down, which was nice.
Nice.
After the Kickstarter. I did do a Kickstarter for a Tiny Duino So Arduino is like this open source. It's an open source microcontroller. That's all it is. It's a microcontroller, but it's like on a standard board with a standard layout. And then you can attach modules to it called shields that like literally just plug in. And the whole thing is this open source hardware initiative. And that became the DIY thing and then into Make and all of that stuff. Microcontrollers are really neat, like really, really cool. If you want to know how computers work at the very low level, most microcontrollers are programmed in assembly or C. That is the way to go, for sure.
And print a case for it on a 3D printer, and you can sell it. Suddenly you have a complete device.
Yeah, exactly. So the 3D printers are really exciting for that. Like,
Seems like 3D printers are now the difference between just being able to, you know, create your own board and then actually making it into a saleable product. Like it's
yes and no. I still think we're at the prototype stage with the 3D printers, right? They're not quite commercial grade. Like you're not going to be able to do that. But
and it's still easier to, you know, send something off to China and having them make
it
a million.
It still is, unfortunately. Yeah.
So
microcontrollers are kind of the core of all the DIY stuff. Like, once you learn microcontrollers, a whole new world of interfacing. Microcontrollers are the thing that allow you to interface your logic and your code into the real world, right?
Right.
So you get sensors that can detect temperature and can detect moisture sensing and all this stuff because they change the electrical properties of this thing. That change in the electrical properties comes into the microcontroller as a data reading of binary ones and zeros. Yeah. And then you just like sort of read those values. And now you're interfaced with the real world. You can send a signal out into the real world, a one or a zero that becomes literally a voltage out. And so you've got this register where you push a word into the microcontroller out on these pins. And like, if you push a five out, then pin one and pin three will be high, which means they'll either be 3.3 volts or 5 volts out. And you can see that in the physical world, like your code made this go from zero to one. And you can see it on a voltmeter or on an oscilloscope or something like that. And that's like really exciting. And so everybody who already knew about microcontrollers, they were like, well, microcontroller by themselves are really cheap. They're like $3 for a microcontroller. But all of the stuff that goes into like actually turning a microcontroller on, putting power on it, and then getting that interface out to the real world is all really annoying. And it's all kind of what we would call boilerplate if we were talking in software, right? Like you have to do the same things over and over again. And so people decided to standardize it. And they did that with Arduino. Arduino is an open source hardware project where they put an Atmel microcontroller in the center. And then, well, actually, it doesn't matter as long as it has the same pinout or on the board. And then they have the same physical board. And so they make these and then they sell them. So a dev kit for an Arduino costs about $50, which is not that bad, but it's still, that's just a microcontroller. It doesn't actually do anything at that point.
And we've talked about like intermediaries for things in the past, like Ninja Blocks and stuff that let
another layer of abstraction.
But that's not enough for like your electrical engineers and
it is not enough for me as a
computer hardcore engineer. Yes.
So when I first heard Ninja Blocks, I was like, Ninja Blocks. Okay. Yeah. Right. I need the full microcontroller. I need pulse width modulators. I need all of the things that are on it. And so, $50 for a microcontroller, that's not that bad, even though, I mean, a controller itself costs $3, like I said. For the dev kit, for the ability to program it, because programming microcontrollers is actually a bit of a pain. Like, if you're trying to do PIC, now you need a programmer, and a programmer's $100. So getting a $50 thing that can be programmed over and over again is a huge win. However, that doesn't help you when you're trying to do what I'm trying to do. So in the New York City subway system, we've got all these advertisements for air conditioners that their big selling point is they have an iPhone app. And, right. So, like, people in New York City don't really have central air. Like, in, I mean, you do if you live in a modern luxury building, but if you don't, if you live in a shithole like I do, you just have a window air conditioner. Sure. And my window air conditioner has a remote, which is great, but I can't do any home automation. I can't set the temperature really with it. I mean, I can, but it doesn't really work. So this company, Cool, Frederick, I think is their name.
Frederick
makes this air conditioner called a Cool. And they realize that people in New York City don't have central air, that they all have window air conditioners, everybody.
Well, for the size of the apartment, so a window air conditioner is plenty.
It works. Yeah. It works.
It's not going to cool a three-bedroom house, but
it's just
that?
Not as nice as like having a thermostat that you set to a temperature, and then it knows either to do the heat or the air conditioner.
Or an app or whatever. Right.
And so their thing is that they have an air conditioner that has an iPhone app that allows you to set the temperature from anywhere in the world, right? Like, you can just fire up your iPhone app and turn on your AC before you head home. And I was like, wow, that's great. How much does this cost? And so I did some research. $1,000 for the air conditioner. They want $1,000. And that doesn't include the module that you need to make it wireless so that you can actually use the iPhone app. That's additional money. And I'm like... Right. So as a computer engineer, I'm like, well, forget that. This is a microcontroller problem. You just wire up a microcontroller into your air conditioner, and you can do that too.
Yeah.
So the problem is when you start looking at the Arduino line of things, it doesn't have enough stuff, right? $50 you pay for the Arduino, and then the shields that connect to it that are supposed to expand its capabilities, that give it wireless internet access, that give it... Ethernet or power or just whatever thing you want. Each of those shields costs $50.
And Arduino is not very small either. It's a decent size.
It's pretty big. Which
plus you start to tack everything else onto it. It becomes
kind of large, and then it becomes impractical to embed in a system into something. Yeah. It's good for development, I think.
Right.
But then along comes Raspberry Pi. And what makes Raspberry Pi so amazing for the do-it-yourself hacker types? It's incredible. It's a single board about the size of a credit card. It has on it a CPU, a GPU, 256 megs of RAM, a wired Ethernet, two USB ports, an HDMI out, composite video out, and stereo out. It is a computer on a credit card chip. You can so in order to program it, it has an SD card slot too. That was the other thing that you probably want. SD card slots on Arduino was another shield, like, to add SD capability. And so... You take this Raspberry Pi, you get your SD card, you flash it with this Linux, and now you've got a full working 700 megahertz Linux computer that has the power of an original Xbox One. And so you can plug it into your TV through the HDMI and everything and have a media center for 30. Oh, so this is the magic thing. It costs $35, the entire board. When I got it, I bought four of them. And it has the... what's called general purpose I/O, GPIO, which allows you to wire this device up to either other devices or like into my air conditioner. And so I can use this GPIO. It's running full Linux. So that's something that microcontrollers don't do. When you program a microcontroller, you program it with the code that it's going to run. It doesn't have an operating system. It just reads your code from start to finish, and it goes into the while loop and like starts reading inputs and starts doing things. The Raspberry Pi has a full operating system. It runs a version of Debian. And so, like, I hooked it up to my television. It gets powered over USB, micro USB. So there's a micro USB port, but it only has the power ports. It doesn't have actual communication over that USB port.
Right.
But you can run it off of, like, you know those little iPhone chargers?
Right.
So you just plug that into the wall, this tiny little brick. You plug a micro USB cable from that USB out into this Raspberry Pi, and it's working fine. To get it programmed originally to put the Linux on, so I hooked it up to my television for HDMI because I don't have a monitor that has HDMI, and I don't have a DVI adapter. So I hook it up to my like giant LCD TV. I plug in a USB keyboard that I had laying around, and to get power, I plugged it into my PlayStation 3 into the USB port. And then I turned on the power and the Raspberry Pi boots up. And sure enough, on my like 55-inch LCD, like Linux. Starts booting down. And so you've got this thing. It's 700 megahertz. It can play HD movies, stream them over your thing. You've got a whole media center PC. I'm going to use one of them because they're only $35 to... I installed Apache. You can just type apt get in Apache, like install Apache. And sure enough, Apache, it's got a little web server running on it right now. It's not wired into my air conditioner just yet, but it's got the web server there. I'm going to use a standard REST call to be able to program my
And it's small enough that you can just unscrew the front of your air conditioner and stick it in there.
Incredible. It's like the size of a credit card. Yeah, and so Raspberry Pi is the future. Sorry, Arduino people. And so, yay, that's the revolution. Yeah, so Raspberry Pi was really popular at Maker Faire. 3D printers are really popular at Maker Faire. There's this whole, like, do-it-yourself, because you could combine, you know, an Arduino with a 3D printer and create, a little, not just a toy robot, but a toy robot that moves in response to infrared commands that can be programmed in whatever language you want, Lua.
Gyrocopter, whatever,
Oh, gyrocopter. So that's a...
Bet you saw a few of those at Maker Faire, too.
I did.
I'm so jealous.
You know who had the most interesting one? The EPA.
Really?
Yeah, the Environmental Protection Agency was there at Maker Faire, and they are doing some cool stuff with UAVs and these sensors and embedded electronics to measure air quality samples around town. Yeah.
They used to have to do this with balloons, basically, right? And now balloons can move around.
Exactly. So they've got a helicopter that's RC that they fly over forest fires to gather air samples to figure out like what is going up into the air and stuff. It's got GPS on it. Basically UAVs, right? They're just flying them around collecting air samples. I love it. I love it. Who else was there? There were automated turrets for paintball.
Okay.
Where it's got a camera.
like the little portal guy. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. See that? The little portal guy. Oh, it wasn't as cute. Like, there you
go. It's all about the voice.
Where are you? So that's all basically what I've been doing has been low level hacking hardware. It's been great. It's been giving me a lot of ideas for projects and things like that. But you've been working on some stuff too recently.
Kind of. I've been out of town. Seems like every weekend this whole actually almost half the month of September I've been in Florida, been in Atlanta, been all over the place. But I mentioned on the Facebook page the other day that I've been trying out a new typeface in Vim. This one's really cool. Adobe released its first open source type family called Source Sans Pro, and then their UniWit
monospace font.
A monospace font called Source Code Pro, which I thought was very clever.
I didn't realize that those two things were different.
Yeah, they're the same family, but they're one of them's monowidth and one of them's not.
Okay.
So, but the monowidth one is great. I started using it a couple weeks ago. Yeah, in Vim, and it's extremely readable. I was really impressed. There's a great image they posted on their blog where it shows a one, an L, an I, and a pipe. It's so clear, even at any type size, which is which. And it's something you really take for granted until you actually look and you're like, what's the difference between a lowercase L and a one? Yeah, I'm a couple of weeks into that. I really almost barely noticed the transition, but the big difference for me was that I was able to lower my type size in Vim a whole point from 12 points to 11 points, which gives you that much more space to type.
Yeah, DCMR code. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's been fantastic. So
that's great. I actually did start using that based on your recommendation, but I didn't realize that there were two different ones, so I'll have to see whether I'm using the monotype one or not.
Well, you would know if you weren't using monowidth, but...
Yeah. Okay, I think I probably am then. I'm using Source Code Pro. I have a little trouble telling the difference between that and ConsoleOS on Windows, because I program in a Windows environment at work nowadays. I use Mac at home, which is nice because I can get this font on both the Mac and on Windows.
Right.
And in Sublime... Now my editing experience is consistent across all of them. Right. So I use Sublime in
For me, mode. It felt like there was slightly more space between all the letters, but there actually isn't. It just appears to be. Like the way way it's set up is it seemed like it was wider at first, and then after half an hour of looking at it, you stop noticing. And the same number of, letters fit per line.
I think this is really important. I mean, we look at these things all the time, all day, every day. I think it's important for us to have a really good font, so I'm really happy that Adobe
really
decided
to do this.
Really
easy to take for granted, and it's awesome. Really impressed. Also, just impressed that they were willing to put this up on SourceForge, make it start.
There is a GitHub version of
type.
It. Yeah, they've been forked into GitHub too.
So go Adobe.
Yeah, really cool. Go Adobe. Well done. Normally we'd be like, oh, your tools are so expensive, but. So I bought a voice-controlled alarm clock.
Yeah, you're just playing with your alarm clock, which is pretty cool. I like the voice.
Yeah, her name is Ivy.
Ivy.
She has a very nice voice. But at first, when she first came, everything worked great. You say, hello, Ivy, and she's like, oh, hello. What can I do for you? You set the time. The best part is that you set the time by saying, like, set time. And it's like, okay, what time is it? And you just say, it's 7:46 p.m.
They're all just trying to be Majel Barrett, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you were bringing up a good point about Siri launching.
Right. It feels like Siri really kind of ushered in a new era in voice technology. Not that Siri itself is anything special. Honestly, I haven't been able to get Siri to do much of anything on my, I just got iOS 6 on my iPad and it's shit.
Yeah. I can't get her to do anything. I can't even get her to beam me up anymore.
But at the same time, it seems like everyone has voice recognition or is trying to get voice recognition into software. I know Android had it first. I don't want to hear about it. Dictation software has been doing this for 10 years. But it seems like when Apple does something, suddenly it becomes cool and everyone else has to try.
I've always said that NFC will not become mainstream until Apple
does
it.
This is why I was so disappointed there was no NFC in the iPhone 5. It's not that suddenly proves it as secure or proves it as some great technology. It's that if Apple does it, then a whole bunch of industries suddenly say, hey, this is viable.
You're absolutely right. Something interesting about that, you and I were talking earlier tonight about patents and about the touch patents for Apple. And you brought up a really great point, which is that the mouse is actually a secondary choice. We wouldn't have wanted the mouse.
Yeah, the mouse, we wouldn't have chosen the mouse first. The mouse only came into being because we didn't have the processing power or the kind of the sensor technology to deal with touch yet.
Right. And we wanted to interact with computers with touch, and we want to interact with computers with voice. And it's only now, just now, 30, 40, 60 years after the computer revolution.
Yeah, the typewriter kind of evolved naturally into the keyboard. But then it was like, so how do you actually, what's a pointing device look like? And a pointing device is naturally your finger just touching the screen. Everyone wants to touch the screen. My boss touches the screen all the time. And I'm like, I have to wipe it off with the Windex. Your inclination is to touch the screen.
Yeah.
And the mouse is just a intermediary for your hand to point at something.
Luckily, as good tool users, we do eventually get the feeling that the mouse is not separate from us, that we're just using the tool naturally, sort of like driving or using a game controller to control a character on the screen.
Which is why you get these jokes like slide to unlock. You know, I've had slide to unlock since my bathroom door locked with a little slidey mechanism. It's not like touching these touch patents actually are expressing anything new.
Yeah, it's sort of like the iPad plus the Bluetooth keyboard is what we always wanted with computing.
Right. Yeah, every 5-year-old knows how to use an iPad, and every 2-year-olds know how to use the iPad. You know,
right?
And after they've used the iPad for 5 minutes, they walk up to the TV and try to touch things.
Yeah, right? That's stupid kids.
Kids.
So it seems like one of the last stories we have is that the U.S. government is writing open source code now.
That's right. They have their own GitHub repository.
I know. I love that.
And they write in PHP, as it turns out.
Oh, yes, sad.
No, sad.
Yeah, but they've released their they've got this thing for creating petitions of the government. And they've released that and all the source code for it. I think the beer recipe that the White House has open beer source. America.
Yeah.
Of movies, software, and patents.
Right. Movies, music, and microcode, according to
movies,
Snow Crash.
Music, and microcode. Nice. Snow Crash was ahead of his time, for sure.
Right.
Maybe the last thing we should talk about is patents, the America Invents Act. Okay. So recently Congress has passed this thing called the America Invents Act, which allows for citizens to comment on patents as they're being applied for. So the way the patent system normally works is that you apply for a patent and then you are actually supposed to be providing some prior art saying, like, these are some things that could be like ours. And then the patent clerks also do the research. So this is what you pay the patent application fee for, is to pay for the research into discovering whether or not your patent is unique and non-obvious.
Right.
But the patent clerks are not always experts, especially as technology has evolved. Like, why would you or I, Ben, ever go work at the U.S. Patent Office when we could have a very lucrative software career?
And why would you ever submit an opinion to the Patent Office unless you actually had something to gain from the patent to begin with? And so it turns out that the only experts actually filing any opinions with the Patent Office are people who are, you know, involved
in somehow. Interest. Yeah.
Right.
So. And so part of the America Invest Act has said that now normal citizens can weigh in.
Right. They're crowdsourcing.
And they're crowdsourcing yes. this thing Our because they know that the patent office is sort of out of their depth nowadays.
Sure.
And so they've gone to Joel Swolsky and his company at Stack Exchange and created this thing called Ask Patents, which is a platform that allows you to go and view patents and then submit prior art, and people can vote up and down. It's on the Stack Exchange right. platform, so it works just like all of that. But that's the idea, is to try. I guess the patent office came to him, which is great.
That's awesome.
I did have a concern, though, and so I asked it on there. Basically, when I worked at Microsoft, they forbid us from going to the U.S. patent site. Like, it wasn't blocked from our computers. We could go,
right.
but the lawyers were like, don't go. Because of this provision in the patent law called treble damages, or for willful infringement. And so I asked on this patent site, I was like, you know, is having this site like a risk for engineers? Because even looking at the difference between, like, if you infringe on a patent and you didn't know about it, you're still infringing, right? It's a strict right. tort. It's a strict liability tort in law.
But if you'd done any research,
right?
Whatsoever.
But if you knowingly infringe, which is called willful infringement, the court can order triple damages.
Right.
And so Microsoft was like, no engineer should ever go to the U.S. patent site in because we risk this triple damages thing for willful infringement.
Hmm.
And so I asked them about that, and everybody seems to see the consensus is like, no, there's no problem with engineers looking at the patent site. There's no problem with them looking at this Ask Patent site, but I still wonder.
Yeah. Such a broken system. So sad.
Yeah, it's sad. I don't think we need software patents. But at the same time, I do think that the Apple-Samsung case was rightfully decided.
Yeah.
And not just because I'm an American and Apple's an American company. Up until 2008, all smartphones looked one way. And then after 2008, suddenly right. all smartphones looked another way. Mm-hmm. And Apple spent a lot of like 3-5 years worth of research and development and engineering and design and specification into creating the iPhone to make it look the way it looks.
Yeah. And Samsung
can
argue.
Just came along and copied it.
And they can argue that they had, you know, one of their 600 prototypes for their new thing happened to look rectangular.
Right. Like, but that interface with the icons and the way they slide and stuff like
exactly.
That Apple spent a lot of time in research and development.
And no one was pursuing that. Someone may have drawn mock-ups that looked similar to it at one point, but no one was pursuing that line of production.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Until,
and the point of the patent system is to make it so that we have innovation, right? It's to force people to not copy each other, but to actually come out with unique and interesting
right.
things.
Well, the purpose of the patent office is so people don't create trade secrets anymore. The
right,
system
right,
of trade secrets is a terrible, terrible system where everyone just, you know, when someone dies, they die with all the knowledge they'd accumulated. And
right, and in
spend,
exchange for right. releasing that knowledge into the public, you get protections.
You get protection. Right,
right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so we see, like, Windows Phone is absolutely different, completely different from iPhone. And now the new Androids, like Ice Cream Sandwich and above, I guess, are actually completely different from iPhone. But originally, not so much.
Yeah, and now we have the worst of both worlds, which is that software companies are both, you know, keeping trade secrets. They're keeping secrets off. They're not open sourcing their software. Even when they have patents, they could
potentially
be
protecting Google algorithm is definitely a trade secret.
Yeah,
the way they PageRank is definitely a trade secret and not
patented. And there's no way they could legitimately, I mean, even if they wanted to patent it, no, everyone would just immediately start to benefit from that knowledge, right?
On that happy note, I guess we will leave you this week. Thanks for listening. We'll have more shows soon.
Yeah.
All right, later. Bye, everybody.
Bye.